Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. After a long, grinding primary battle, it appears that Mitt Romney will be the Republican Party's presidential standard bearer this fall. But before that, this May, he'll be giving a commencement address at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, a school founded by the late Jerry Falwell. Governor Romney's trip to Lynchburg is no doubt an effort to win over Southern evangelicals, a reliable voting bloc for Republicans, but one that has inherited a deep suspicion of Mormons. Here today to discuss the historical roots of this suspicion is Professor Patrick Mason, the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. He will be discussing his newest book, The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South, published by Oxford University Press in 2011. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Art.
Well, first, please indulge me, and briefly, because I'm just curious about this, I'd love to get your take on Mitt Romney's nomination and how you think this will play out in the Bible Belt.
Well, I think, obviously, it's really historic. I mean, Romney will be the first Mormon major party presidential candidate. Of course, several other Mormons have run for president. Joseph Smith ran for president in 1844 before he was killed. But this really marks a new chapter for Mormons and their integration into American political life and possibly the mainstream of American culture. A lot of people are comparing this to John F. Kennedy's 1960 election and what that did for American Catholics. And I think that's not a bad comparison. We'll see how the results go, but I think it'll be really interesting to see how Romney plays in the South. In some Southern states, he did better than expected in the primaries, and now that he has the nomination, of course, a lot of evangelical leaders are sort of rallying to the standard. Even Pastor Jeffress, who had referred to Mormonism as a cult famously back in November, has now openly endorsed Romney. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out if he's able to stir up enough fervor among evangelicals the way that George W. Bush was.
Well, we will all keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very eager to get into the book, and in preparing for this interview, I consulted the Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, and lo and behold, no entry on Mormonism. The Encyclopedia of Religion in the South did have a brief entry, along with one on the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But I think it's fair to say that this has not been a heavily studied subject among Southern historians. So first, why do you think this is? And second, what drew you to this topic?
Well, I think it's kind of natural that there hasn't been much focus on Mormonism in the South, partly just because of numbers. Until very recently, the last 25, 30 years, there haven't been very many Mormons in the South. Just numerically, that they've been statistically insignificant in most places. And of course, most of the Mormon story, as people have told it, even in the 19th century, it's been focused primarily on the West, on Mormon origins and then the exodus to the West and their development in Utah and then their battles with the federal government. So the South really hasn't played into the narrative. And that was one of the things that drew me to the project. Originally, this came out of my dissertation, which in some ways was broader in the sense that I looked at violence against a number of religious minority groups in the South, including Catholics and Jews and African American Christians. Mormons were just one of the groups. It turned out that I thought they provided the most compelling story. There was more violence against them than against other groups, and that to me was kind of the question that drew me in. Why, given their tiny numbers, did they spark so much violence and so much hostility in this region when other historians have looked in other places to look at the Mormon story in the 19th century? So that was really what drew me to it.
I want to pick up on something that you mentioned there, because so much of Mormon history focused on this era is centered in the West. So what do you think your focus on the Southland does for this story in terms of just Mormon history in the 19th century?
I think it does a couple of things. One, for Mormon history, so much of, if you read the scholarship on Mormonism, and in the last couple of decades, there's just been an outpouring of really high quality scholarship on Mormonism, especially in recent years. But again, most of that is in the traditional areas of Mormon settlement, whether it's in New York, Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, in the antebellum period, and then, of course, in Utah for the rest of the 19th century and beyond. But what I wanted to do and what I found is that by focusing on the South, I was able to tell a story of moving from the periphery to the center, that I was able to look at the impact of this Southern violence on Mormon identity. It turns out that the Mormons in the 1870s and 80s, which is primarily where my book focuses, they were reading stories of all these missionaries in the South who were being whipped and kidnapped and driven out of town and occasionally killed. And this reinforced a kind of Mormon persecution narrative, certainly, an oppositional identity among Mormons. Of course, they didn't need too much more reinforcement. The federal government was bearing down hard on them. But it also reminded them that they were fighting the fight, too, that it wasn't just their ancestors in the 1830s and 40s, kind of the first generation of Mormons that had experienced violence, but they did, too. And this really reinforced that identity for them. But I also think the other part of it, in focusing on the South, I think it revises and nuances our understanding of anti-Mormonism. Most of the study of anti-Mormonism in this period, and there are some really fine books on it, focus on the kind of legal and judicial and congressional action against Mormons that was in Washington, D.C. It's somewhat the cultural dynamics of anti-Mormonism. But by looking at the South, we're reminded that anti-Mormonism, yes, it was legal, it was cultural, it was congressional, but it was also very violent. And there were mobs out chasing Mormon missionaries and killing them in some cases. So I think that gives it a kind of edge and other layers to the story that we don't get by not focusing on the South.
Right, and let's continue on that, because as much as your book is about Mormons in the South, you focus more generally on violence and the culture of honor, that is, that fueled it. Could you talk some about how you conceptualize violence, because I found that very interesting, especially as it relates to Mormonism in the South, and how you think this made your narrative unique?
Yeah, you know, part of my background, my PhD is in history, but I also have a master's degree in international peace studies. And as part of that, I got dove into some of the theoretical literature on religion and violence. And I'm fascinated by these kinds of broader questions of why are people violent? What pushes them to violence? And of course, I'm not a psychologist. This book doesn't have much psychology in it. So it's not really on that level of analysis. But looking historically, I'm interested in these questions of the limits of religious tolerance, especially in America, where religious tolerance has been such a hallmark of our identity, or at least we'd like to think so. Obviously, the history bears out that it's more complicated than that. But I'm interested in the limits of religious tolerance. I'm interested in civic order and where that breaks down. And what are the limits of the way that religion operates in the public square? The Supreme Court case, Reynolds v. U.S. in 1879, which dealt with Mormon polygamy, it was the first time the Supreme Court had ruled on the Religious Freedom Clause of the First Amendment. And since then, they established a belief action distinction, which has governed First Amendment jurisprudence ever since. And so I'm interested in these broader questions of how religion operates in the public sphere. And violence, I think, wherever there's violence, for me, that draws me in and says, okay, there's something really, you know, the friction is so intense here, so that there's something to look at.
You know, what I found admirable in the book was your stories of torment and abuse that some of these people faced in the South. I'm wondering, is there any of those stories that maybe stands out above the rest, or to put another way, something that you think, an event that you think typified the Mormon experience in the South?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the fun things about doing history is really getting into the archives is all these great stories that come out, and there are a ton of them in this book, and I'm always drawn to the first story I tell, which opens the book in the introduction. This is of Parley Pratt, who was a Mormon apostle. This actually takes place before the Civil War. Most of my book takes place in the 1870s and 80s. But this Parley Pratt was one of the leading lights of early Mormonism, widely published pamphleteer, and traveled the world as a missionary, really influential voice in Mormonism. But he had during his time in California, actually, as a missionary, he had met this woman whose husband was abusive. They were from the South. This woman and her husband, their name were Hector and Eleanor McLean. They were living in San Francisco at the time. And so they met Pratt, and Eleanor was converted to Mormonism, but Hector, her husband, was militantly opposed to it. And he was abusive, he was alcoholic. And so she eventually left him, left Hector and traveled to Salt Lake City and married Parley Pratt. Brigham Young married them, and she became a plural wife of Parley Pratt. Well, of course, Hector wasn't real thrilled about this, and so long story short, he chases down Parley Pratt. He chases him across the country, hunts him down, and murders him in cold blood in Arkansas. And in a lot of ways, this captures some of the central themes of my story, that people didn't kill Mormons because they read the Book of Mormon. People didn't kill Mormons because they had a different theology. Yeah, they were worried about those things, and there was plenty of ink spilled about it. But when it came down to it, at least what I argue is the central point of contention, and what really put white Southern men over the top in their willingness to kill Mormons was the defense of Southern womanhood. And when Mormons came in, and of course Mormons with their open acceptance of polygamy and the centrality of plural marriage to 19th century Mormonism, that constituted an absolute threat to not just to white Southern womanhood, but of course to white Southern manhood, which was predicated on the defense of womanhood. And so I love the Pratt story. It's a very rich story, and really represents some of the key themes in the book.
Well, and of course, too, this is a way of thinking about how the sections use anti-Mormonism, as you say, to kind of reunite in this period. You talk about how Southern Democrats and Northern Republicans sort of found common religious and national ground on this issue. Could you talk about that sort of way in which anti-Mormonism was a bridge between these former wartime foes?
Yeah, this was, for me, was one of the more significant finds as I did my research and got deeper into the archives, is that this isn't the story that I tell. At least I think it's not just a Mormon story, it's not even just a Southern story, but it's an American story, in that Mormons are really central in a lot of aspects of American politics in the middle part of the 19th century, beginning in the 1850s and then into the 1880s, the period I cover. And for most of that time, and of course polygamy is such a contentious issue, and for most of that time, Southern Democrats had actually allied themselves with Mormons. And Mormons' greatest allies in Washington were Southern Democrats, and it was along the lines of states' rights, of local sovereignty, and that the Southern Democrats sensed, I think correctly, that if the federal government could legislate against polygamy, it could also legislate against other domestic relationships, namely slavery. And so this pattern began in the antebellum period of Southern Democrats. Of course, they didn't particularly like polygamy, but they saw it as a broader political issue. And that continues even after the Civil War. And Southern Democrats see Mormons, again, politics makes strange bedfellows. And well into the 1870s, Southern Democrats are still lined up with Mormons. It's not until the 1880s where just the overwhelming weight, the kind of moral conviction and the moral crusade against polygamy, the Southern Democrats, in some ways their evangelical sensibilities in this case overwhelm their local, their localism, and they say, well, we just can't tolerate Mormon polygamy anymore, and so they get on board with anti-polygamy legislation, and that's what puts it over the top. But this, you find statements of Southern Democrats endorsing Republican presidents, Rutherford Hayes and others, and you just don't find that on many other issues. That there weren't very many points which Southern Democrats and Northern Republicans found common cause in the 1870s and 80s, but anti-Mormonism was one of them.
Well, I want to return to something you briefly mentioned earlier, that this was a study that evolved out of a dissertation that looked at responses to religious minorities in general. So how did the response to Mormonism differ from the Southern response to Catholics and Jews? What was unique?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, and for me, the biggest factor I found there was how the minority groups themselves responded differently in terms of their experience in the South. Mormons were, in this period at least, were insistent on maintaining a distinctive identity. They prided themselves on being a peculiar people, and polygamy was the outward badge of that, although they didn't practice it in the South. Clearly, that was what set Mormons apart. Catholics and Jews in the South were different in this period. They very consciously adopted a kind of assimilationist strategy. Their numbers were very small too, and they recognized that if they wanted to get along, they could keep their religious distinctive, but they weren't particularly interested in sticking out culturally. And so both Jews and Catholics pursued a similar course of accommodation to the broad patterns of Southern culture in this time period. There was violence against both of those groups, but it was different than the kinds of violence that was visited upon Mormons. The violence against Jews was largely related to economic grievances of Southern farmers in the 1880s and 1890s, the kind of agrarian violence we saw in Louisiana and Mississippi and other places. The violence against Catholics was largely racial and ethnic. It was mostly violence against either Mexican Catholics in the Southwest and in Texas, or against Sicilian Catholics, who were kind of the latest round of immigrants. And much of the violence against Catholics was by other Catholics, by French and Irish Catholics in Louisiana. So there are different dynamics, and I think that's one of the key things when we look at religious violence, is we can't just paint with a broad brush, but we have to peel back the layers and say, what's really going on here? What are the dynamics of violence at play?
Tell us briefly, what do you hope the reader of this book will take away from it?
I think a couple of things. One is that American history is, while we like to think of it as a narrative of progress and of pluralism and of tolerance, that was hard won. And the kinds of pluralism and tolerance we find today doesn't always resonate in the past. And what are the peculiar dimensions of that? What made Mormons so objectionable in the 19th century? And what price did we exact from minority groups in order for them to find acceptance? I think this is true of Mormons and many others, that they had a price to pay in order to find acceptance in America. And so we have to think about that in terms of what are the boundaries and what are the limits of tolerance in America.
Very good. Well, tell us briefly, what do you have in the works? What can we expect to see from Patrick Mason in the future?
Yeah, my next big historical project, I'm just getting started on a biography of a guy named Ezra Taft Benson. So I'm moving into the 20th century now. He was Secretary of Agriculture under Dwight Eisenhower and kind of a chief architect of an extreme form of conservatism in the mid to late 20th century. He was a Mormon apostle, eventually became president of the LDS Church. But in some ways, he was the predecessor of the kind of extreme right politics that we see with Glenn Beck and the Tea Party and some of these things. So that'll be moving to the 20th century. Some of the same themes of religion and politics, a little bit less violence, though.
Well, with that, I would like to conclude this podcast. Again, the book is The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South. Thank you to Professor Mason for joining us. For our next podcast, JSR co-editor Mike Paskay will be interviewing Jeff Wilson on his new book, Dixie Dharma, Inside a Buddhist Temple in the American South. After that, I will be talking to Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter about his new book, God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right. A special thanks to our technical director, James Garrity, and to St. Francis University's School of Arts and Letters for sponsoring this podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support the Journal of Southern Religion, please visit our website at jsr.fsu.edu and go to our donations page. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening, and we'll be talking with you soon.